bright array of city lights, as far as I can see, the great white way shines through the night.
Welcome to Success Made to Last. I'm Tim Moore. This is the podcast that helps you live the best version of you, where we interview people who live lives of excellence. Brought to you by Blinkist, where you'll find thousands of nonfiction books condensed to 15 minutes, so you can test drive them or just browse them for the key ideas. That's Blinkist, B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Folks, today we are in the presence of country music royalty, plain and simple. Actually, let me restate that more correctly. We are in the presence of American popular music royalty. Today we are talking with the legendary Bill Anderson. Bill has had over 400 of his songs recorded by others, rendering countless number one hits. Artists from the 60s like Connie Smith and Jerry Lee Lewis and Lefty Frizzell, all the way to today with artists like Kenny Chesney, Brad Paisley, and George Strait. In addition, he has recorded over 40 albums of his own, with 9 of his singles reaching number one. Bill has been a member of the Grand Ole Opry since 1961 and was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame in 2001 and inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame, all genres, in 2018 and was the second recipient of the Chris Christopherson Lifetime Achievement Award from the Nashville Songwriters Association in 2018. Who was the first recipient, you wonder? Willie. And for the last 23 years, Bill has been the host of what I think is one of the best TV shows ever produced in my lifetime. And I'm not young. It's RFD TV's Country Family Reunion, but more on that later. Frankly, that's just the highlights. Well, Bill, that's a lot of achievements and memories. Welcome to the show.
Well, no wonder I'm so tired if I've done all of that. Thank you, Tim. It's great to be with you.
Well, thank you as well. You know, Bill, I received last night in the mail, it came a little later than I'd hoped, your biography, which I'll talk a little bit about later, but I read about 100 pages last night, and I thought to myself, just in the 100 pages was a lifetime. You've done an awful lot of things. And as the biography says, you were born in Columbia, South Carolina, but raised mainly in the Atlanta, Decatur area and in Georgia. Tell us about your early days, your family, what Georgia was like. You know, this is the 30s, 40s, and 50s, or 40s and 50s anyway. What was Georgia like in those days? And tell us a little bit about your childhood dreams, which, as the book tells me, did not necessarily include music, might have included your left arm.
Yeah, my childhood dream was to be a Major League Baseball player, and I was a pitcher, and I do everything in the world that I do left-handed, so I was going to be the next, I don't know, Whitey Ford, Eddie Lopez, I don't know, those were some of my heroes growing up. But music was something that I've always loved, but it was just not something that was on the front burner in my life as a kid, something that I enjoyed as a fan and as a listener, but not necessarily something that I thought about pursuing as my livelihood. I came from a small family. I've written a lot of songs about being from a big family, but there were, in reality, just the four of us, my mom, my dad, and I had a sister, four and a half years younger than me. We grew up in a little town called Decatur, Georgia, right outside of Atlanta. It was a little small town in those days, but Atlanta grew and kind of swallowed Decatur up and kept on growing. It was a good place to grow up. I have a lot of fond memories of my childhood.
Tell me a little bit about your father. Particularly, he seemed like he was a very, very strong-willed man. I mean, I was impressed by the fact that I think it was in 1945, he literally just quit his job because he didn't like it anymore and decided to start his own business. People didn't do that in 1945, did they? Talk a little bit about your dad.
Well, I know he scared my mother to death. He came home one night and at the dinner table, he said, well, I quit my job today, and there's my mom and two kids, and I'm sure she had this sudden nightmare of, well, how are we going to eat and how are we going to survive? My dad was from a rural family down in the middle part of Georgia, grew up on a farm in his early years and later moved to a little town called Griffin, Georgia. His dad left the farm and went into the insurance business when they moved into Griffin, and my dad kind of followed in those footsteps, and he decided that he was just tired of working for other people and he wanted to start his own business. He started a little one-man insurance agency in Decatur, Georgia in 1946, and by the time that he sold it to some of his employees in the 1980s at some point, he had built a very successful business and was a man that I was very proud to call my dad and looked up to tremendously.
Yes, you portray him really well in the book. And after forming a band in high school, Bill, and winning an award and feeling really good about that and being approached by a major league or at least minor league ball clubs to play baseball, you decided to go to the University of Georgia. Now, people didn't go to college as frequently then as they do now, but you chose to go to the University of Georgia and fulfill what I sense was your not obligation, but a promise that you'd made to both your mother and your father. Talk a little bit about that decision. Your parents weren't poor. You weren't poor, but they weren't of great means either. So you had to work your way through college as well. Talk about the University of Georgia and your experiences there and why you went in the first place.
Well, I went in the first place because it was really the only thing that my mother and father ever asked me to do. They allowed me a lot of freedom growing up. I was able to have my little high school band, as you said, and we ran all over the country playing shows and doing things. And as long as I kept my grades up, my mom and dad were okay with that. They let me do it. You got to go back and remember that my mom and dad were of the generation that grew up and got married, actually, during the years of the Great Depression. And they got married in 1933, right at the tail end of the Depression. And education was so important to them. They figured that education was kind of their ticket, you know, off the farm and off the treadmill to oblivion, as somebody once called it. And so they just really stressed to me all my life the importance of an education. And they were really right. I have people ask me all the time today, said, well, did you go to the University of Georgia and learn how to write songs? No. They didn't have a course in how to write country music songs at the University of Georgia in the mid-1950s. But having the opportunity to have that education, to do the only thing my mom and dad really ever pretty much insisted that I do, it was just something that I never thought of not doing it. It was just put into me and instilled in me from the get-go that I was going to go to college. And like you say, I ended up working my way through, and it turned out to be a wonderful experience. And how about them dogs?
But, you know, it's funny, you just tickled a memory of mine, Bill. My father was born and raised in southeast Oklahoma during the Dust Bowl, you know, in Oakey. And when I was a kid, he just beat into my head I was going to go to college. And I didn't even know why I was going to go to college at an early age, but that was what I was going to do. And your story reminded me of that. That depression seared a lot of people, but it also gave them some real hopes that their kids would not have to deal with something like that.
You understand what I'm saying, because you had a similar situation that you never really considered not going to college. You were going to go because that's what they wanted you to do. And the reason they wanted you to do it was so that you could have a better life than they had.
Yes, yes, because they had seen things that they didn't want us to see, right, Bill? You studied journalism, you were a DJ, you worked your way through college, you did sports writing, and you performed locally, all those things, and you even went to college, Bill. You were probably, as your autobiography begins to suggest, you're probably really beginning to think, you know, maybe I could be a performer. You're writing songs, I think. talk about those college days and what began to formulate in your head as to the potentiality of what you might do afterwards.
Well, as you mentioned, Tim, I had a little country music band when I was in high school, and we played around the greater Atlanta area, did some radio, did some television and all, and kind of whetted my appetite. I mean, I enjoyed it. Again, I was not thinking of that as a career. When I got to the University of Georgia, I ran into a couple of guys who were older than me. They were going to school on the GI Bill, and one of them was working as an early morning disc jockey on one of the radio stations in Athens where the university is located. And he loved country music, and his other buddy, the older guy, he loved country music. And I got acquainted with them and was totally fascinated by the one that worked at the radio station, because I had grown up, of course, in the years before television, and radio was my best friend growing up, and I was always fascinated with radio. And these guys wanted to get up a band, so we got up a band. We got a Saturday afternoon show on this little radio station, and my friend showed me a lot about how to run a control board at a radio station, how a disc jockey works, how radio all comes together from the inside. So not only did I get fascinated with the music and having the band and singing and playing and performing, but I got really interested in radio. And after my freshman year at the University of Georgia, I was determined I was going to find me one of those disc jockey jobs and get on the radio somewhere. And I rode all over the state of Georgia trying to talk somebody into hiring me, and ended up finding a job right under my nose there in Athens, and went to work at a station. But they wouldn't let me play country music, so that didn't make me real happy. I wanted to go somewhere where I could play country music on the radio, and finally got that opportunity in a little town called Commerce, Georgia, which was kind of the jumping off place for my whole career.
Amazing, isn't it? And you were writing songs, and at the tender age of 19, somehow Ray Price recorded City Lights in 1958. I think he recorded that in San Antonio, Texas, or at least his label was in San Antonio. It was a little label called TNT. No,
that's not right. Let me back you up there.
Okay.
I recorded City Lights for TNT Records out of San Antonio.
Oh.
I mean, I was in Georgia, but I was able to make contact with a man named Bob Tanner at TNT Records. And he released my record of City Lights. Ray Price was on Columbia Records. He was a star of the Grand Ole Opry in those days, one of the hottest acts in country music, as he was for many, many years. And Ray heard the song City Lights and went into the studio and recorded his version of it. But his was on Columbia Records. Mine was on the little label out of San Antonio.
Oh, I'm glad you did correct me, because I thought to myself when I read that somewhere that, gee, Ray Price was already a big star. What's he doing on a little label? So thank you for that, Bill. And, you do research, but it doesn't necessarily always work out the way you'd like. So thank you for that correction. And your song goes to number one, not the song you recorded, but the one that Ray recorded, your first recorded song by somebody else, as I understand it. How did you find out about it? I mean, maybe you just heard it on the radio, and what was your reaction, your family's reaction? And gosh, that's got to be feeling like you just signed with the Yankees.
Well, yeah, it was pretty close to that. It was a lot of dreams coming true there all of a sudden, taking that little song that I wrote in Commerce, Georgia, where they didn't even have many city lights. And
Ray
Price recording it, taking it to number one. And of course, that was what ended up opening all the doors for me in Nashville. I was still living in Commerce and working as a disc jockey on the radio station. But every time I got the chance, I'd hop in my little old beat-up Ford and I'd drive to Nashville and try to meet as many people as I could. And it was pretty easy after City Lights, because I could say, I'm not just Bill Anderson from Commerce, Georgia, but I'm Bill Anderson from Commerce, Georgia, and I wrote a little song called City Lights, and they'd say, well, come in, would you like a cup of coffee? So I got a lot of free cups of coffee and met a lot of wonderful people as a result of that song.
Bill, there's a great story in your autobiography about your grandfather, who was a preacher. And he said something to you on his deathbed that I just really I read it and I thought, my God, you know, that's like something out of a novel. It's so profound. And tell that story to the folks about what he said to you about this new profession, this music that you were in, and what you might be able to do with it.
My mother's father was the one you're talking about, the Reverend Horace Smith.
Okay.
He was a minister. He lived to be 88 years old, and he spent most of his life in the ministry in the Methodist Church. And he told me, literally on his deathbed at the hospital, he called me over to the side of his bed one day, just shortly before he passed away, and he called me Billy. He said, Billy, I don't know much about this business that you're in, but he said, I do know one thing. He said, you'll be able to reach more people with one song than I've reached with every sermon that I've ever preached in my life. And that was such a profound thing for me. It was such an humbling thing to think that here was a man who had dedicated his whole life to good things, spreading the gospel, preaching, changing lives. And yet he came along at a time before radio, before television, before he could really reach the masses of people. And the fact that here I had these opportunities lying in front of me with radio and television and phonograph records and, of course, the things that have evolved, the internet and all of these things. And he had the foresight to say that I could reach more people with one song than he could reach with all the sermons he had ever preached. And that was a very sobering thought, and it's something that I've carried with me and never lost sight of throughout all these years.
You know, when I read that, it really made sense to me because you can see, Bill, you know, I'm sure, I don't know if you do it consciously, but you can see that in your show, Country Family Reunion, that his calling, you know, animates the show, you know, values animate your show. You have special, you know, you've had special editions, on gospel music and on growing up in the church. And, you know, I thought to myself, my goodness, you know, all these years later, Granddaddy's words still speak to him. I guess, do I have that right, Bill?
You have it absolutely right. And I just hope and pray that my grandfather's smiling down and saying, well done. I hope he would be proud of me because he put that seed inside me. And I hope he's happy with the way that I watered it and fertilized it and helped it to grow.
Well, if they got RSD TV up there, Bill, I'm sure he is happy. Very happy indeed, because I'm sure he's watching at 7 o'clock Central on Friday night, every Friday night like me. So here you are, you're 19, you got a hit, you decide to go to Nashville. That's a long time ago, Bill. That's 60 years ago, and over 60 years ago, and Nashville was a different town than it is now, but it was also sacred ground already because some really amazing people had already come through, you know, from the Carter family to Jimmy Rogers to Hank and many others. What was it like? I mean, you're just a kid, Bill. I mean, what was it like? Talk about the city, the people you met, and for that matter, the era and how it's different than it is today.
Well, I was such a fan. I tell people today that a long time before I was an artist and standing in the spotlight, that I was the fan that bought the ticket, came in and sat out in the audience, watched the show, hung around after the show, got autographs from my heroes. Never was a bigger country music fan than I was. And I came to Nashville both intimidated and yet very proud and honored to be there. I felt like after City Lights it had the success that it had, staying at number one in the charts for 13 weeks and opening all the doors for me, I felt like, well, maybe I do have something to contribute. But golly, I mean, I was just so in awe of all of the people. I remember, you know, meeting Ernest Tubb and meeting Eddie Arnold and meeting Carl Smith and Webb Pearce and Ray Price and the big stars of the day. And while I was able to kind of stand there beside them and eventually perform beside them on the Grand Ole Opry, I was still very much in awe of them. I had so much admiration and so much respect for them. You know, I thought Nashville was a big, big music town when I moved here, but of course it has become so much more of that in recent years than it was back then. the music business was pretty much a small player on the whole Nashville stage back in those days. In fact, so many people in town didn't even want to acknowledge the fact that the music business existed. The blue blood fathers or forefathers of our town kind of looked down their noses at it and kind of pretended it didn't exist. But, of course, those of us in the music business, we ended up getting the last laugh.
You sure did, Bill. Well, listen, I want to just stop here for a second because I want to read some copy from our sponsor, Bill, and then we'll come back to you there right after that. But folks out there, let me tell you about a great way to learn new things and keep up on the topics that interest you most. It's a new app called Blinkist, B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. This is very cool. It works on your phone, your tablet, or your web browser. Blinkist takes the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information, from thousands of nonfiction books and condenses them down to just 15 minutes that you can read or listen to. You say you like to read books from cover to cover? Well, so do I. I use Blinkist to test drive books I think I might be interested in, and then I read the condensed version, and if my interest is piqued, I go and buy it. However, for many books, all I want to do is read the condensed version, and that's great too. So with Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read and listen to their massive library, all the books you want for one low price. And right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer to just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/success and try it for free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist.com/success. Thanks, Bill, for allowing me to do that. And for you waiting, Bill, in your book, it literally starts out with a vignette about something I had no idea about, and you were at a very low point in the early 1990s, and hadn't had a hit in a long time, and thought really you must have felt like Sinatra did about the same age back in the day when everyone told Sinatra that, you know, this kind of music that he played wasn't relevant. And then he came out with, I think it was My Way in the mid 60s, 65, I think. But you're sitting there thinking, gee, I'm irrelevant. And there's a great story in the book about your hairdresser and Vince Gill. And I just love to hear you tell that story, you know, and how it compelled you into having another great, section of your career.
Well, I had started out as a songwriter in Nashville, as you have said, in the late 1950s. And for 20, 25 years, I had written nearly every song that I wrote by myself. I was not into co-writing with other people very much. And somewhere in the early to mid-1980s, country music began to change, and I thought, golly, I've been doing this for over 25 years. I don't know if I'm going to be able to change who I am and what I do. And so I don't know, I just sort of got involved in doing some other things. I was hosting and performing on game shows on television. I was spending a lot of time on the West Coast in California. I ended up on a television soap opera called One Life to Live, which was kind of typecasting because my whole life has been a soap opera. But I kind of got away from music, and especially from the creative end of music, and I didn't know if I would ever write songs again. But the other was a lady here in Nashville who, for the past many years, has been Dolly Parton's hairstylist, and she was cutting my hair back in those days, and she also was cutting the hair of a newcomer from Oklahoma in Nashville named Vince Gill. And she kept telling me how much she liked Vince Gill, and she kept saying, you need to get to know him. Well, I had met him, but I didn't really know him. And she was telling Vince Gill, you really need to get to know this Bill Anderson guy. You guys need to get together and maybe write some songs and things. So after resisting co-writing for the most part for quite a few years and really kind of being away from songwriting in general, she got Vince and I together in the mid-1990s, and he turned out to be everything that she said he was, and we became instant friends and wrote a couple of songs together. And he recorded one of them called Which Bridge to Cross, Which Bridge to Burn, that went to number one in the charts. And it kind of opened up my eyes to the possibility of that. Hey, maybe I can write some songs again. Maybe there are some things to say. And from meeting Vince Gill, I got to meet other people, other young writers, other young artists. And I really started kind of a second songwriting career in the end of the 90s and into the 2000s. And it turned out to be, I guess, the most fertile period of my life, actually, even though I wrote all those songs and had a lot of big hits back in the 60s and 70s. The things that I was able to write in the later years have been just as big or bigger. I've written a couple of songs that were voted the song of the year and won a whole bunch of awards and things. But it all started with the lady cutting my hair telling me I needed to get to know Vince Gill.
You know, it's funny how life works sometimes, isn't it? There's a great line you have in the book that someone else mentioned to you in the around that time that, it was one thing in the 1950s and 60s to get a number one hit that might but help you buy a car. But in the 90s, you discovered that if you had a number one hit, you might be able to buy the dealership.
Well, Tom C. Hall said that back when he had a record by Alan Jackson. He found out the difference between hits in the 60s and hits in the 90s. And he was right, you know. And so, fortunately, that was a part of the equation, too. I never got into the music business, though, to try and see how much money I could make or whatever. There'd probably been a lot of things I could have done that would have been equally or more financially rewarding. But I got into it because I love the music, and the fact that you get paid to do it, that's just kind of the icing on the cake.
Yes, indeed. It's a beautiful confluence. Bill, let me change lanes just a little bit. I was so happy, really honestly happy to see that you were one of the people that Ken Burns interviewed for his 16-hour country music PBS series. I presume that you watched the series. Were you pleased with the result?
I thought Ken Burns did a great job. Yeah, he and his team, that's a tough subject to tackle because they went all the way back to, you know, the early 1920s and even some prior to to show the roots of country music and where it came from and took it right on into the modern day era. It was a mammoth undertaking. But as Ken Burns has done with baseball and the Civil War and various things that he has undertaken, he did a tremendous job of presenting country music, not only to those of us who know it and love it, but to people who never paid much attention to it before. I can't tell you how many people have come up to me and said, you know, I never paid that much attention to country music, never listened to it, never really liked it all that much, but Ken Burns' documentary really opened my eyes. And so not only did he make entertainment, but he created information and helped reflect the history of our music and our art form.
I happen to agree with you. I didn't want to tell you that before you answered, but I happen to agree with you. I think it's the best thing he's done since the Civil War, and that's not to degrade or minimize any of the other things. It was a fabulous series, and you know, I'm a country music aficionado at some level, or big fan anyway, and I learned so much, particularly about the early days. It must have been, Bill, for you, like watching your life be rerun too. I mean, you knew everybody on that show post 1960, didn't you?
Well, you're right, and it was, and to watch the. I think the thing that pleased me so much was that Ken Burns and his people treated our music with such respect. They treated our people and our music with a lot of respect. Obviously, they couldn't talk about everybody. They couldn't give everybody 20 minutes on the show, you know, but I thought they hit the high spots and really did a great job. They did it with respect and dignity. And I think Ken Burns actually became a pretty big country music fan in the process.
I think you're right. I've heard him interviewed 3 or 4 or 5 times since then, and it's really clear that he fell in love with the music that he himself, you know, didn't even know much about when he started. You made one comment in your the excerpts that Ken had of you on the show that struck me as something that I've always noticed about country music stars, and you were talking about the shock to the family of country music, and you used the word family, at the death of Patsy Cline and Hawkshaw Hawkins and Cowboy Copas in that famous plane crash in 63. And you talk, please talk about that sense of country music, that sense of family, especially in a moment like that. And why is it that country music seems to have that is sort of that family feeling so deeply embedded in itself?
Well, I think probably because most of us come from pretty simple and humble beginnings. Family was important to us in our childhoods, and our feeling for family probably has just extended beyond our biological families out into our community of country music. And plus the fact that in my era, when I came along, and so many of us came along, you know, country music was not the music. We were kind of a minority. We were the ones that other people made fun of and picked on. And I wrote one time in something that I wrote, I said, in the beginning, it was us versus them. And, you know, when you kind of got that mentality, it kind of causes you to band together. And it comes down to the point that when one of us gets cut, we all bleed. And that's what happened when Patsy and Hawk and Cope were all killed in the plane crash, and Randy Hughes, of course. It was like they just cut the whole family, and we all just stood there and bled. You know, it was a very sad and tragic time, as it was later when we lost Jim Reeves in a plane crash, and then the other tragedies that had hit our business down through the years.
Yeah, that's a great answer, Bill. It's a very good answer because, you know, there's one of the things about country music is that you all came from very similar roots, and that's a very, very interesting answer. I'm glad I asked that question. And when I watch Country Family Reunion, and there's that word again, you know, I one of the things that endears it to me is that I get the real sense, you know, that those folks in the room, that they care about each other and they respect each other and they root for each other. And frankly, they exhibit all the best traits, not the worst traits, but the best traits of a family. And it's so much unlike everything else on TV, in the media and on TV. And I find it to be extraordinarily endearing. I ask myself sometimes, is it actually real? But talk about the values that you try to bring to that show. We touched on it earlier about your granddad, but talk about the values that you tried to bring to that show and why I react that way. I can't be the only person on earth to react that way.
Well, thank you for saying that. What you see on Country's Family Reunion is what you get. It is very real. It is not rehearsed. It is not scripted. When we sit down in that circle to visit for 4 or 5 hours at a time, which we do as we're taping those, recording them. I don't guess they use tape anymore. I guess it's all done digitally. But the only thing that we have that even resembles a roadmap of where we might go is I have a list of 7 or 8 songs that we need to get sung and performed within the hour of each allotted segment. The only thing that is rehearsed is the music. The singers come in and give the band the chance to get familiar with their music and everything, but the talk and the conversation is strictly off the cuff. I try to just kind of open it all up. I'm not the star of the show. I'm kind of the traffic cop. I'm the guy that comes in and kind of directs the movement of the attention from one person to another and just tries to keep it going. The people and the concept are the stars, the fact and the music, the fact that we're all there together. And the things that people say are the things that just, you know, come from their heart, they come from their memory. And like I said, what you see is what you get. It's certainly not like these scripted shows and all on television. It's just people, as my daddy used to say, flying by the seat of our britches. And that's exactly what we're doing.
Well, you're flying pretty well. And you know, this is not a question, it's a statement. You can see in the eyes of all those people in the room, Bill, when they look at you, that they're looking at their favorite uncle or something like that. They look with you with great respect and affection. And quite frankly, it's deserved. I love that show. Folks out there, if you've never seen Country Family Reunion, I really do think you're missing something. Even in the last few weeks, maybe a few months, actually, you know, there hasn't been any new country family reunions, but they've been airing best ofs, and they're just as fabulous. In some cases, they're even more fabulous because you see some artists who are gone now that you get to see again, and that is a really, really, really special too. But it's an extraordinary show, and like I said, there's nothing like it on TV. Bill, on your website, in a column called Bill's Journal, you wrote a graceful and touching elegy to Harold Reed of the Statler Brothers. And I bring this up because, one, because it's really, really well written and it's really great. But two, his death really didn't get much notice, you know, during the noise of the pandemic. And I thought you might want to talk with him about him just a little bit. You knew him a long time, and I get the sense he was one of your oldest friends as well.
Well, Harold was a very dear friend. In fact, all of the Statler brothers have been dear friends of mine down through the years. I'll tell you a little story that you probably won't, so I'm sure you don't know. I was on the show in Canton, Ohio, the night that the Statler brothers first performed for Johnny Cash. And the Statler brothers told me that they actually met me before they met Johnny Cash, and I was talking to them backstage. At the time, they were known as the Kingsman's Quartet, and they had primarily been a Southern gospel group, but they were wanting to branch out and get into country music. They had this natural flair, particularly through Harold, for comedy, and they had other things they wanted to do. And I stood on the side of the stage on New Year's Day in Canton, Ohio, and watch the Statler brothers go out and totally tear the audience to shreds. I stood there next to Johnny Cash, and he was grinning from ear to ear. And before the night was over, he had hired them to become a part of his road show, his touring show. He opened the door for them to get to record for Columbia Records. So my roots with the Statlers are very, very deep. And Harold and Don, particularly, dear, dear friends. And then Jimmy Fortune, who came along when Lou DeWitt passed away. Jimmy and I are very good friends. It was very, very sad to know that Harold had passed away, but he lived a good life. He entertained us. He made us laugh. And he was a wonderful human being. And if anybody wants to read what I wrote about him and what I write about a lot of my friends that passed away, they can go to BillAnderson.com and click on Bill's Journal and read those things. Because I like to write, and I like to pay tribute to the people that have been so special in my life. And Harold Reed was certainly one of those people.
Well, I saw on the website that you have a tour plan starting on July 30th. In fact, you're going to be in two dates in Llano, Texas, which is 50 miles west of where I am. I'm in the first suburb, one of the first suburbs north of Austin. Is that tour still on, or do you not know at this point? Is that just a dumb question?
None of us really know what's going to happen. You know, most of my dates have been rescheduled. Those Texas dates were supposed to have happened back in April, and they were moved, you know, later in the year. We're not seeing any of our concerts actually being played right now. And if I were a gambling man, I would say that unless things, you know, turn around fast and considerably, that they'll probably be postponed again and moved maybe even into next year. Most of my friends, and particularly the artists who play the big arenas and stadium shows and the big festivals and all, they've canceled out everything for 2020, and they're looking towards 2021. And I think that may be what we'll all end up doing before it's over. It's very sad. It's very unfortunate. We miss it. I miss the road. I miss the fans. I miss the Grand Ole Opry. But, you know, it is what it is, and we just have to accept it and try to make the best of it.
Well, I don't know if you've ever been to Llano, Texas. It's a beautiful little town. And whenever those go, I'm going to be at one of those. So I'll come up and say hello to you. And Bill, is there anything you want to plug to our audience? You mentioned your website. I would love to mention your biography, which I got yesterday. It came in the mail slower than I wanted, but that's no problem. I read the first 100 pages last night, and it's dropped down. It's just fabulous. It's just one of the best autobiographies I've ever written. it sounds like you, and that to me is, you know, I can hear your voice, and to me that's comforting. It's called Whisperin' Bill Anderson, An Unprecedented Life in Country Music. It was hardcover in 2016 and paper in 2018. Is there anything else that you'd like to plug, Bill, at this point in time?
Well, you don't ever ask somebody in my business if for something they want to plug, because they always have something they want to plug. I've got an interesting album that's about to come out. It's called Bill Anderson, The Hits Reimagined. And what this is it's 10 of my best known songs, some that I've recorded and written for myself, some I've written for other people, songs like everything from City Lights, Bright Lights and Country Music and Poor Folks, up to Whiskey Lullaby and Give It Away and some of those songs. And what I have done is gone in the studio with just a couple of acoustical guitars and an upright bass and just kind of recorded these songs in a whole new light. They're very intimate recordings, and some of them I've never actually recorded before. It's a unique approach, I think, for me and for the music. And not only do we have the 10 songs vocally, but we've also recorded 10 instrumental versions of the songs. I've never put out instrumental versions before, but there's 10 of the songs vocally, 10 of the same songs instrumentally. People can have their own karaoke. They can sing along or whatever they'd like to be. The album is available. The CD is available at BillAnderson.com, and we're running a special through the month of June. A little bit cheaper than you can buy it a little later on. The release date is actually July 24th, but we've got the advance copies available. And again, it's just BillAnderson.com, and I appreciate you letting me mention that, Tim. Thank you.
Well, that was a setup for that, Bill, because I noticed it on the website, and I'm going to purchase one, and I'm looking forward to it very much. And Bill, I really thank you for your time. I don't want to keep you too much longer, but I really appreciate it, and I want to wish you the best, you know, in all phases of your life, from your family to your work and to your show. And to all of you out there in podcast land, remember to go to successmadetolast.com to register for our newsletter filled with fun information about our future guests and what I think is great stuff in general. And go to your podcast distributor, iTunes, Spreaker, etc., and rate our show, please. Till next time, go out there and live the best version of you.
So thanks to our sponsor, Edward Jones. They are our trusted financial advisor. And Edward Jones has been instrumental in helping us pivot our lives built around health, happiness, travel, and adding value to other people's lives. You can contact our advisor, Serban Marasini, by emailing him at serban.marasini@edwardjones.com. And thanks again to their sponsorship of this program. And thanks to our sponsor, Gracefully Yours Greeting Cards, and their hilarious Church Kitchen Lady cards. Church Kitchen Ladies are a bunch of maybe 20 million volunteers across the United States that work in 300,000 churches, and they say stuff like, mind your own biscuits and life will be gravy. They also say, crunch tacos, not abs. And you're crazy is showing, you might want to tuck that back in. And one of our favorites is Life is Short, Lick the Bowl. If you want to find out more about the wonderful Church Kitchen Ladies and join their roundtable, go to gracefully-yours.com today and find out about Church Kitchen Ladies and purchase all the rest of the fine Gracefully Yours greeting cards.